So, John, you ready? Okay. Come and get it.
Hi, I'm Joan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight to share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was a common drunk. I thought I was perfect. I knew all the answers to life, and all I did was turn up another gin. I used to say it's gin that makes you want to sin. And that's what I did. I broke all the rules. But let me tell you just a little bit about me. I'm a twin. Some people say, "Are you identical?" And I said, "The good Lord would not make two like me." So, no, I'm not identical. But I grew up in Virginia in a house where there was no alcohol. My father and my mother separated when I was 8 years old. It was very traumatic, and I needed some way of getting out of myself. And I did that by learning to read, and I used to say I can be in any country, in any world, in any time period through reading. But what I was doing was running away from life. I didn't like life the way it was, and I was too young to be able to believe in those days that I could change it, and so I ran. Now, I'm going to talk about running quite a bit, and I'm going to tell you I don't do that anymore. I used to say, if you have to drive a railroad spike through my foot, I'm going to stand here and face whatever life has to throw at me. And now, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't have to drink. Okay. I was one of five children. We grew up in Tidewater, Virginia, the big shipyard there, and Navy Yard, and Army bases, and Air Force bases, and lots of men in that area, getting prepared to go off overseas for World War II or working in the military bases. My mother had maybe a fifth grade education. She had, at the time when she was 13, her mother died, and she dropped out of school to raise the rest of her brothers and sisters. So she didn't have a very good education. The one thing she knew was how to cook, clean, and take care of people. And so we opened a boarding house, and that got us through the war. We had plenty of food to eat because all of the young men that came there until they got their notice to go into service had their draft cards, and they had their little coupons for getting food. And so we had all that we needed in the way of food. But when I was eight, I would stand in a chair in the kitchen and stir the pots of food to put on the table for the boarders. And it was not an easy life. We had an old house out in the country. There was no indoor plumbing, but all these young men that came were from the mountains of North Carolina and West Virginia, and they were familiar with an outhouse. So that's the kind of life I had. I wanted to run from all of that, but it wasn't possible, so I did the best I could. I studied and read and worked hard and got through my early years. Then when I got into high school, I loved to sing, and I was in a little operetta. I was the fairy godmother in Cinderella. And my husband went to a different school at that time, But our principal gave his parents tickets for my school performance. And he came and he heard me. I was the Mother Hubbard looking thing in scene one. But then by scene two, I had on a beautiful ballerina costume with a tiara and was singing. And my husband said, I'm going to look that girl up when I get to high school next year. Well, he did. My last name was Phillips. His last name was Millar. And so I sat right behind him in several classes. And then he saw my twin sister. And that's who he wanted to date. But Joyce was very shy. I was the one who had all the answers in life. And I told everybody how I had all the answers. And so he just gave up trying to talk to her because I came up and answered all of the questions. So he dated me. We had our first date 65 years ago this past July. I had to be 15 before Mother would let me go out. And so we went on a hayride at the beach. It was wonderful. And this past June, when we were in Tidewater, Virginia, we went out to that beach and walked the beach like we did 65 years ago. And it's just as nice as it was then. But anyway, getting along, I was a young girl and I wanted to go to college. I didn't have the money to go to college, so I had to finish high school and then go to work in the shipyard in Newport News. And I worked in the shipyard for 4 years and saved my money to go to college. When I got to college, I had to work my way through. So I worked in the dining hall and managed to do that. None of this with drinking. My husband was going to school at the University of Richmond. I was up in the mountains of Virginia at a girls' school that we had 1,000 girls there, and I was one of them, working my way through. Then, when I got through that, I realized that we were going to be married, and my husband wanted to get married before I finished school. So we did. And I was just very fortunate that they didn't have enough school teachers in Virginia at that time. And even though I had just 2 years of college, as long as I would continue to go to school at night and in the summer, I could teach in Virginia out in the country. So I did that. I taught school, and that was fine. We were just focused on doing the next right thing. But Donald finished his schooling. I helped him get through. And then we moved to Utah, away from my mother, away from anybody that knew me. I could reinvent myself. I could be anything I wanted to be, and I lived in a fantasy world. So I just reinvented myself. I didn't tell anybody about the outhouse, and I didn't tell anybody about working hard and all that. I was a Virginian of the FFVs, and I was going to be something. Well, I found alcohol in Utah, and that really, really was a joy for me. I could take a couple of drinks and I could be anybody in the world, and I tried that. Now, I should have realized that there was a problem, because although we had no alcohol in my family, there was alcoholism in my father's family. And out of 12 children, 5 of them were alcoholics and drank alcoholically. I found this out when I started years later getting to know my dad and know something about his side of the family, because he lived in Florida. We were up in Virginia, and I didn't know much about that side of the family. But anyway, I got out to Utah, and I had a little son born there, and he was very ill. And it was really awful. We had to put him he came out of the hospital 2 days before Christmas. He had to go back in on Christmas morning. And I was wiped out. I had been up all night long trying to keep him breathing so that he could be okay. And when I walked back across the grounds from the hospital, some neighbors called out and said, "What you need is a drink." And they told me to come up. And I didn't even know what to ask for. And the Andrews sisters had a song, "Drinking Rum and Coca-Cola." And so I said, "I'll have a rum and Coke." Well, they didn't have rum, so I said, "Well, I'll have whatever you have." And I had a lot of it. So that Stuart went back in the hospital on Christmas Day, and about 6 o'clock, I woke up enough to know that I needed to go see if he was still living. That's the way alcohol did me. I would take a drink, and the drink took me. And I went wherever the drink took me. I'm not telling you these things to romanticize alcohol. That's not it. But alcohol was my drug of choice. It did for me what I could not do for myself. And as long as it was working, I was using it. Even though very much at the very beginning of my drinking, I would suffer blackouts. And I said, "Oh, great. This is wonderful. I don't have to have those newsreels rolling in my head. I'm in blackout. That's great." And I would find myself sitting in a kitchen on somebody's kitchen floor. I would find myself under a canoe in the backyard. I would find myself, because I would be, what would happen to me is I would be life of the party, having a great time, just able to talk to everybody, wonderful, wonderful experience. And then I would start coming down, or my husband would start coming down. And that's when it got scary in my house. That's when the yelling and the screaming started and the misbehaviors started. And that's when I would get terrified, because it would remind me of my father. My father, who was labeled insane and put away in a mental hospital. And that's when I would hear the screaming, I would try to hide. I would hide wherever there was a convenient place, which would be like in the backyard, under the canoe. He won't find me here. Up in the attic, going out the... We had this wonderful two-story Georgian house. Wonderful house, like Tom... what was his name? George White's house in Williamsburg. It was a great house. But I had a window that let me out onto the top of the den. It was 12 feet or more, 8 feet or more up to the top of the house, on the top of the roof. At 3:30 in the morning, I was out in my nightgown on the top roof of the house. I was frightened. I had barricaded myself in my bedroom and crawled out the window to get on the top of the roof. Now, I was a school teacher in DeKalb County. I was somebody, I thought. And I didn't want people to have a bad opinion of me. I didn't want my neighbors to know I was an alcoholic. But when you are running around in your nightgown at 3:30 in the morning on the top of your roof threatening to jump down to the sidewalk, your neighbors are going to know you're an alcoholic. Or they're going to know something's going on with you. You're ready to be in a straitjacket if you're not an alcoholic. So anyway, that's the way my life was. Now, I've told you enough about how it was. What I want to talk about is coming into this program. I called and I talked to somebody at headquarters to find out where an AA meeting was, because I had been drinking all week and I was in misery. I was the uvula in my throat, that little thing that hangs down, was the size of my thumb from alcoholic poisoning. And I could hardly swallow. I decided to check out AA and see what it was like. They told me there was a meeting 1 mile from my house in Tucker, Georgia. That was too close. I was a valuable person. I'm a school teacher of science and math. I'm married to a physician. I'm not going to go to that meeting and have anybody see me that knows me, because I'm too important to admit that I'm desperate and I need AA. So I called this friend that I knew was in AA, and he thought I was calling for his expertise in, he was a CPA, and he thought I needed him. And I said, I do need you, but it's because I'm drinking too much. And I can't go to that meeting they told me about over here, because I'll run into people I know. And I can't let them know my husband is married to a drunk. He said, do you think, is Buckhead far enough away? I said, oh yes, that'll be great. He said, well, I want you to come down to NABA Club, and I will meet you there, and I will take you over to Buckhead to a meeting that's far away from your home. So, being an alcoholic, I thought that was a great idea. And I came over here that night. Now, I didn't want anybody to talk to me. I had not been teaching for a year because I had to make a choice whether to teach school or drink. And, of course, drinking won out. So I came in here. I didn't want anybody to know me. And I was downstairs where the cafeteria is. And I had a book in front of me. I was a yoga teacher as well. And so I'm reading all about yoga, and somebody came over to me and they said, oh, do you teach meditation? I said, I can teach meditation. I know. What type of meditation do you need? And I told them how I used to do all the meditating in my closet. Well, you can do that when you've had about 6 gin and tonics beforehand. And so I was like a zombie in there. But anyway, people came and talked to me, and then Ross showed up with Elizabeth, and they took us to our first meeting. And I went to just see what AA was like. Well, I sat in that meeting, and I looked across the room, and here was a man that looked like I felt, drooling, bloated, red-faced, and he talked about how awful it was. He had had a slip. How awful it was to have to come back. And I heard these steps. Now, the second step is what caught my attention. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I knew I was crazy. And somebody else was going to find out, and they were going to put me away. And so when I saw that step, I said, that's for me. That's for me. So after the meeting, when they said, is there anyone here who would like to come up and pick up this white chip and start this way of life, then I jumped up and got it. On the way home, my husband said, there you go. Everything you try to take advantage of it. I'm the alcoholic in this family, not you. And I said, I'm alcoholic enough for me. I mean, really. I mean, here I was, wanting to kill myself, threatening to kill myself, but thinking that God would just paralyze me from the neck down and have a brain. I would be lying paralyzed and a brain that could perceive everything. And so I couldn't kill myself by running into these abutments out here on 85. So then, but I was so bad, I needed to be punished. And so what I did after drinking one time was go out and chop all my hair off. Just chopped it all off. The next day, I woke up and I thought, oh, what in the world have I done? So I went to Rich's and I told them that I'd had a permanent and that chemical had just broken and melted my hair. And I had to buy a wig. Well, I ended up with 3 wigs so that every other day my hair was a different color. But those are the kind of things I would do in these alcoholic stupors. So anyway, I got my chip. And my husband was telling me that I was not the alcoholic. I was honing in on his lifestyle. He was the alcoholic. Well, I got my chip, and I have to tell you, I've got 20 seconds more sobriety than he has. Because I jumped up and got the chip, and then he decided he better get up and get one too. So at those first few weeks, it was hard. I really jumped up out of bed several times, flipping the sheets, looking, turning on the lights, because I said there are ants in our bed. Well, it was me and my nerves because of alcoholism. I just felt something crawling all over me. But I just kept coming to the meetings, and sometimes the only thing that kept me from drinking was because we had come in on a Monday. We had gotten this couple that brought us to our first meeting became our temporary sponsors 5 days after we joined. And in their story, the wife had gotten upset with her husband, and she went out and drank 7 days after picking up her white chip. So for the rest of her life, she had 7 days less than her husband. And some days, being so brilliant, you know, being this really intelligent woman, I said, I'm not going to drink today. I may drink tomorrow, but I'm not drinking tonight, because he will have more sobriety than me. So I hung in there, and we came to this meeting. I was given an opportunity to work here and help with the Thanksgiving dinner that first year. I came in on the 10th of November, 1975. And that Thanksgiving, I helped here fix up a Thanksgiving dinner. The next thing we did was a New Year's party. They said, you need to learn that you can have a good time without drinking. So a whole bunch of AA people that I had met joined us here for the New Year's dance. And I had never danced sober. Because I grew up being very strict in a very strict church, and you didn't dance. You didn't wear earrings or lipstick or any of those things. And I mean, I did all of that later. But I learned that in NABA Club, you could have fun and not drink. You could have fun and be sober. I learned through the program that you can have terrible things happen in your life, traumas. I would never go to a funeral. From the time I was 12 years of age, I would never go to a funeral. Well, one of my friends was decapitated on the highway, and I had to go to that funeral. I came to an AA meeting, and I said, I can't do that. I cannot go to a funeral. I cannot go be around that woman's body and her family and talk to her. They said, Joan, you don't have to like it. You report for duty. So that was something that went into my little toolbox. Report for duty. Don't have to like it. You just do it. And I went, and all the way to Tennessee, I was shouting, God, I don't want to do this. I don't like it, but I'm going. And it was a blessing for me. It was a blessing for the family. And I learned that we can do all things through God, who gives us the strength if we call upon Him. And so that was another tool I got in my toolbox. I learned that it is not how you do things. They can be imperfectly done, but you just report for duty and you do your best. You turn to God, the God of your understanding, and He will always be there. I've learned that I have something of value, and I never thought that I would be able to take this worthless life I was living and turn that around and be able to give people strength, share my strength and hope of this program and what it has done for me. And if it could change me from the kind of alcoholic that I was, where I would be fighting in the kitchen with a butcher knife and my husband with a broken bottle and our children standing in the doorway weeping. If I could go from that to cleaning myself up and getting out and being accountable, then I had something I could share, something I could tell somebody who was feeling helpless and hopeless and weak and weary, just weary of life. Life is my life today, and I just turned 80 this June, and my life today is beautiful. My life is full. I have lots of good things that I do. What I have learned is that drink is my greatest enemy. Liquor, I thought, was my friend, but it isn't. It turned against me. You may not know when it happened. I know that it happened for me where I went from drinking socially to alcoholically. It happened for me when I spent a year in London and I spent most of the time in the pubs. That's when I ended up drinking alcoholically. I went from being able to drink to being able not to drink. There was no way I could get through a night without a drink. I would make my decision, I'm not going to drink tonight, and I would be waking up drunk at 3, 4 in the morning. So you may not know when it happened, but know that it did happen to you. Admit that. And how do you know that? Well, you might have a few experiences like I did, like jails and hospitals and people that don't want to be around you. That helped. It is my main business today to stay sober. That is what I wake up every morning and say, Lord, help me to stay sober today. Then I have a chance of having something of worth to tell some people or share with people. It's not circumstances that need to change for me, but it is me. I need to change myself, not the circumstances. I want to become all that God would have me become. I want to be useful. When I moved from Atlanta up to Gainesville, I'd been in every one of the societies you can imagine. You know, going from living in this outhouse and not knowing anything about my family, I found out through Ancestry.com that I had ancestors that fought in the Revolution. I had ancestors that came on the Mayflower. I am an FFV of Virginia. But when I got in the car to move up to Gainesville, I said, Lord, I've done all this stuff with all these societies. I've been in the state level and I've done all that. But I want my life to count, and I want to count some way that's really of great purpose. And I have found that to be AA. A lot of people get involved in their churches, but I said, I sing in the choir, and I do lots of stuff around the church. But I tell them, AA is where I work. That's where I reach out. And that's that. I want to stay in the day, and I ask God to help guide me in what He wants me to do in whatever the situation is that arises in that day. I never leave until tomorrow the things that I know deep down in my heart that I'm supposed to do that day. And that gets me through life. It gives me joy and peace. The peace that passes all understanding is here. It's available to you. And so I'm going to leave you with a little verse. I found the God of my understanding. I didn't want to know God when I got here. I was terrified of Him because I figured God knows my number and it's not good. I can't hide from Him. I run to keep from being found, but He never let go of my hand. So I learned this, and I just shared this with my husband this week, and I want to share it with you. It's not in trying, but in trusting. It's not in running, but in resting. It's not in wondering, but in praying, that you find the truth and the strength of the Lord. You'll find it. You seek Him, and He is there. And I have enjoyed being with you tonight, and thank you so much for letting me share my story. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you, John. I feel better. Who else joins me in that? Anybody going to take a drink tonight? No way.
The journey. Every part of our life is a journey. We journey from spirit to flesh to spirit. We journey through life and the different stages of life. We step off of the path. We get lost. We find the path. All is part of the journey. A journey within the journey. And all the while, we are never lost, though we have the experience of being lost. We have the experience of being back on the path, though it is impossible to step off of the path. For we are on a journey within the journey. So every step we take is a step on the path, and the step itself is a journey. Everything is plain to see, and everything is mystical and impossible to see. It is all part of the journey, or the journey within the journey.
Looking back on yesterday, trying to find a better way to go. But I don't know. The road that brought me had a lot of turns along the way. But that's okay. When you feel like a traveler at the station, searching for some unknown destination, just remember the living's in the learning, and it's not a destination, it's a journey. So much time trying to find a place you just can't go. Now I know it doesn't matter anyhow. The place you're looking for is right now, here and now. When you feel like a traveler at the station, searching for some unknown destination, just remember the living's in the learning, and it's not a destination, it's a journey. It's not a destination, it's a journey.